have found the Business Broker Growth Show with your host, Jason Cutter. This is the podcast for brokers who are ready to stop hoping for deals and start growing their pipeline. Our goal is to bring you strategies, stories, and insights that will be a catalyst to move you quickly from transactional deal makers to trusted advisors. Time for Business Broker Growth.
On today's episode with me, I have Jared Johnson. He is the VP, Senior Business Development Officer at First Internet Bank. Jared, welcome to the Business Broker Growth Show.
Awesome, man. I appreciate you having me on. I'm excited.
I am excited as well. And we'll get to this. We're going to talk about it. You're coming at things from a different perspective than many of the other guests on the show who are business brokers or people in that part. You're on the SBA side, so you're a little different. You're actually not necessarily dealing with the sellers, which is what the business brokers do. You also have a great podcast. You create some content. You also have a fascinating personal branding kind of mode with the hat that we'll talk about where and how that's evolved. And it's kind of fun. So I'm looking forward to this because this is a good conversation. I know it's going to be a good conversation based on what you and I have spoken about in the past. For people who don't know who you are, why don't you give a little intro of like what you do, and then what we can do is we'll go backwards and we'll talk about how you got there.
So I've been doing SBA lending for about 20 years, and I'd say about maybe 12 to 15 years ago, I sort of found a niche almost on accident of financing business acquisitions. I ended up really enjoying it. Felt like it was a little bit more challenging, so it kind of kept me awake and a little bit more stimulated. It was something that I decided to really hone in on and focus on. So for the last about 15 years, I've been doing primarily acquisitions. That whole world has evolved, and I'm sure we'll talk about it as well, going from just kind of normal acquisitions to more of search funds and entrepreneurship through acquisition. And so I've sort of tried to stay in tune with that and help kind of push that all forward. I provide the financing on the acquisitions through, you know, SBA lending, and I'm hyper focused on that. I've also acquired two businesses, sold one of them. And then I also have a community group in Fort Worth, Texas, for individuals that are looking for a business or curious about it, to try to get people together as a community to learn more about it. So quite a few different things, but definitely try to stay within the realm of business acquisitions.
So you said 15 years you've been on the acquisition side from the lending part, correct?
That's correct, yeah.
At what point in your life were you like, this is what I want to be when I grow up? Was there any moment there, or just kind of sneak up on you and happen?
Yeah, I think it snuck up on me. I still have to remind myself that I did grow up sometimes, but it's weird, right? You kind of like look around one day and be like, how did I become 43 years old? And I think I'm still a kid somewhere in there. But I don't think anybody wrote down in third grade their career choices were going to be an SBA lender, but here I am. So I would say, like, in lending in general, when I was in college, I had an opportunity to go do SBA lending and decided to jump in because I didn't really know exactly what I wanted to do when I grew up. And so kind of just stuck with it. And I don't know if I ever consciously decided this is my career and what I'm going to do. I think it just worked out. So.
Yeah, it is fascinating, right? Like it's, I had a podcast before and there was a couple of seasons where like, the final question I would ask every guest is, what did you actually want to be when you grew up? Right. Because it was mostly like salespeople, or it wasn't even like entrepreneurs. It was salespeople. I was like, okay, what did you actually want? It would be like baseball player and firefighter and all these things. Right. Like that's, you know, salesperson is never that, you know, selection in the third grade or SBA lender. I want to be a banker. You know, it's not one of those things. And it's fascinating because I was thinking about this last time we spoke. and then just now when you're talking about it, is there's this total sidebar for the audience, is that there's a book called Be So Good They Can't Ignore You, which is a Steve Martin line. And then it's a take on that where it dispels the passion myth, which people say, well, follow your passions and then go into what you're passionate about. And then you'll never have to work a day in your life, right? But the inverse is fascinating. So someone like you, where I think of like, how did that person who's passionate and loves HVAC ever get to this point in their life? And it's one of those things where you get into it, you get good at it, you like it, you learn a lot, you become better than everyone else at it. And then it develops into the passion instead of passion first. And then you actually get good. You get good and then you become passionate about it. Does any of that fit for you in this
moment? Yeah, I agree. And I think it's funny because people say that, right? And I've had people say, well, you know, if you do something you love, you'll, you know, never work a day in your life. And it's like, you kind of need to add like an asterisk to that, but make sure it pays the bills, right? Because, you know, if you had your choice of what you really wanted to do every day, I don't think everybody would, you know, choose their career. But, you know, some of what we do and what you sort of learn and what kind of keeps you going at the beginning is that you're really making a difference. You're changing someone's life. You're, you know, kind of an integral part of their career and their business and, you know, helping people transfer a business to another person. And so that's fun and it's fulfilling. But I think ultimately as a kid, I sort of always had this like entrepreneurial kind of mindset. I didn't grow up in a, you know, poor family, but definitely didn't, you know, there was times we sort of struggled. And I didn't want that. My dad was a principal at a small Christian school, didn't make much money, but I went to school with kind of the rich private school kids, right? And so it almost like ruined me because I was watching these kids that had everything they could ever think of and I didn't. And so I wanted to almost prove to them that I belonged. I think that's where, like, I mean, I used to mow lawns as a kid. I, you know, painted, I did all things as much as I could on the side. So I had my own money so I could buy things. You know, it's probably a sort of unhealthy way of wanting things. And then as you grow up, you just kind of realize like, hey, I'm actually kind of good at this, but I'm also helping these people, you know, buy and sell their businesses and take care of their families and stuff. But by the way, I can also get really good at it and make money. And then I'm also an extremely competitive person. So like you're saying, you know, be so good at it that people have to pay attention. It's like, I definitely wanted to become the best at it and make sure that, you know, I not only am I helping people, but, you know, you're still making money and being really good at it.
Yeah, I love that. And I could see that about you. We've never met in person, so I haven't spent any actual time around you, but in our conversations, like I get the competitive part. And not that you make it obvious, but one of the things that you said that's kind of triggered that in my head, which is something I wanted to bring up too, is that you've been doing this for 15 years. Some people look at you, and I know that some people who want to get into SBA lending and financing come up to you and say, how did you do it? Like, you seem so successful, almost like, and I, you know, I put in my notes here, overnight success. You know, it's easy. I just do what you do, right? Like, I just show up and I can close hundreds of millions of dollars worth of loans, right? And you're laughing now in the same way that you were laughing when we first spoke about it, because you're like, nothing makes me more like frustrated than people who think like, you just show up and win.
Yeah. Yeah. Overnight, it's more like work all night. You know, so yeah, I think, you know, it's, you have to have a certain personality and a certain, you know, grit, but then also be willing to do what it takes to get there and to constantly be honing your craft and outwork other people. I literally worked till 2:15 in the morning last night, just to try to catch up because I had an event in Houston the day before, and then we were busy all weekend, and I'll usually work on the weekend. So there's a lot of, hours and time that go into it. You definitely don't just wake up one day and say, hey, how did I get here? This is, you know, boom, turned it on and it worked. Like, no. Yeah. And I have people that approach me, like you said, and they'll say, you know, well, I would like to do what you do, and I'd like to be as successful as you. And I, you know, sort of say to them in a nicest way as possible, like, you're not willing to do what it takes to get here. you know, I think you can do well and you can learn. And I think that's great. you know, you can help people undo some deals, but getting to that level, like, it's almost like, be careful what you wish for. So,
yeah. Yeah. It is fascinating too. And you see it a lot online, or I do anyway, is, you know, people who make that statement as well, about others, which is like, you know, people who want the prize or the trophy or the accolades don't necessarily want to do the work, you know, the behind the scenes stuff and the effort that it takes to get there. So it's interesting too, because before we hit record, we were just catching up real quick. And I said, how are things going? He says, really busy, you know, and it's really never slowed down. And what you said was, it really hasn't slowed down for you since 2020. And then I made a comment, which I think is interesting, is that it's like, how much of that is you just building this thing that you've built with your effort, with your branding, with your network, with all that you do, the skills and everything. And then also the market, like, where's that intersection of you being in the position and just riding what you've built, mm-hmm. and the dynamic with the market? So can you talk a little bit about that? Like what comes to mind?
Yeah, definitely. I think there was always sort of this saying that I heard at a younger age, was like, you kind of create your own luck. and so it's like, put yourself in the best position possible to be successful. I tell my kids that all the time. And I think a lot of it was spending years and years kind of honing the craft, learning it, getting better at it, understanding it. Going through the process myself and trying to constantly get better and better and better. And I don't think I've ever looked at something and said, it's perfect. It looks great. It doesn't need to be fixed. It doesn't need to be taken apart and put back together again a different way. And it's like a blessing and a curse, right? And I was talking to my dad about that one day, and he kind of mentioned that's how it was. I was like, well, thanks a lot, you know? So I think I've just always tried to work on getting better at what we do. But then it sort of turned into almost like a perfect storm, where when the entrepreneurship through acquisition kind of gained some steam and really took off during COVID, I was sort of positioned in the right place where, I guess you could look at it as like, I had a head start on everyone else, yeah. Because I had already been working on it for so long that once that became more popular and took off, it just sort of funneled down to me still, because I was already doing it for such a long time. And a lot of the buyers that we see, which have, I mean, we could talk about for hours as well, of like kind of how that's changed, but they sort of figure out, okay, who actually understands this? And like, how can they add value? And so it sort of works its way down to the real kind of players and experts in that field. And I think being that I was already sort of in that role and in that mindset, then when it took off and got busy, I was already ready to go with it. So then it's just kind of accelerated from there.
Then it makes sense, right? Because you have this foundation that's built up, that's in that part. Have you ever read the book Outliers by Malcolm Gladwell?
Yes. Yeah. And I talked to somebody about that the other day on my podcast, and he was talking about a different book, and I thought he was talking about that one, and we kind of went on. And then Bridget, that does all my marketing, was talking about Outliers the other day, because she's pregnant. And so she was kind of like trying to figure out, okay, what do I do for my kids? Cause you go through that whole mindset of like, I'm going to make sure my kids are the best setup for us and all that. Yeah. So it's really interesting though. Yeah. I love those kinds of like studies and books.
Yeah. So one of the things is, you know, what a lot of people know, the takeaway headline from Outliers is the 10,000 hours principle, which also fits into your mode, which generally works out to be about 7 to 10 years of focused effort on not just practice, but improving and learning and growing, you know, 10,000 hours to really get, really master something, right? So it's generally about 7 to 10 years, depending on the amount of effort you put in each week in that mode. The other thing that's fascinating, which is what lines up with you, is that it's not just the 10,000 hours, some of it has to do with timing and also luck, where the stories that he used was like Bill Gates. Bill Gates had his 10,000 hours, he grinded through, and then the PC revolution took off, and like everything he had done in those hours built, and then he was like, if he had been born later or earlier, he wouldn't have been in the window that would have worked perfect for it, right? And so I think about you in that same mode, where it's like your 10,000 hours leading into this, you know, entrepreneur through acquisition search funder mode, where it's like you have the experience where it's like, okay, I know what to do for all of you. With that, so explain a little bit, like, because I know when we spoke in the past, you said how different it is now, like what buying a business used to be about and who used to buy businesses, and then now who's buying businesses and what this whole, you know, acquisition game is about.
Yeah, it's been a really interesting phenomenon, and it's been kind of fun to watch and see. Again, like you asked me, you know, did you grow up wanting to be an SBA lender? Like, I still don't think that a lot of people may grow up and say they want to start a business or be in business or something like that, but very few people grow up and say, I want to buy a business as their career. And that's kind of where I feel like we're headed. And I honestly believe that in the next, you know, 10 to 15 years, like 90% of the acquisitions we see is going to be sort of that model. And which is great for the whole ecosystem. It's great for sellers to be able to have someone to sell to. And it's great for individuals that kind of want to do their own thing and create and continue to improve industries. But I would say, you know, back in 2010, right, if we want to kind of sit around that area, we were doing transaction sizes, maybe up to $1 million, $1.5 million. Like that was a big deal for us to work on. And I say us, there was probably three people in the industry at that point that were really doing acquisitions. And it was more of like a general manager of a auto repair shop that said, I'm going to buy this from the current owner, or I'm going to buy the one down the street and make it my own and kind of take my experience there and grow it. The structures were very different. You normally had a seller carrying 15, 20% of the transaction. They'd put in 10, 15%. And that was sort of the model. Those were the buyers, right? It wasn't, you know, now what we're seeing are more, people coming from like professional organizations. A lot of who I deal with are people that, you know, maybe veterans or officers in the military, special forces, people that go to sort of the, you know, kind of normal big business type schools, Ivy League, and then go work in private equity, you know, venture capital, big consulting, stuff like that, investment banking, and then they'll go to business school. A lot of times in business school is where they're going to discover this whole, oh, I can buy a business and run it. A lot of them are going there to try to figure out what's next in their career, and they sort of discover it. But now we're starting to even see where people go, I'm going to, you know, accumulate some cash, some experience, some knowledge through a career of maybe 5 to 10 years, go to business school, and then start searching for a business. And there's different ways that they'll do it, whether they raise capital from investors and use that to search for a business. Some of them may continue to work while they're looking for a business, and then others will use their own money. But they're the ones looking for a business, and they're typically going to look for a, you know, a little bit more of the upper end kind of small business section. So, you know, purchase price may be somewhere between 3 and 10 million, is kind of more of what they're looking for. And a lot of times they're also looking to, within a couple of years, add on a few more businesses that are either in the same industry or comparable. And so they can continue to kind of grow and make it into a larger business. And that's more of what we're seeing now, a lot less of people that are the general manager at a mechanic shop buying a mechanic. It's a lot more of, I worked in private equity and helped, you know, maybe operate a business or really look at it, got a good network, really good experience in, you know, kind of high level management, are in a good financial spot, and typically will have some money behind them, whether it's investors or family, friends, or they've saved their own money from working in corporate America. And then, of course, we'll also have, you know, corporate executives that have maybe worked their way up for 15, 20 years in a company and decided, hey, I could go do this myself and have the equity and do it that way. And that's a lot more of what we're seeing now.
Yeah, it makes sense. And it's interesting to think about that in basically a short period of time, right? Like if we think of your 15 years in this, where it was, like you said, 2010, 2011, when you were starting out and there wasn't much of a SBA ecosystem like it is now, and who's buying businesses? It's fascinating because when we were talking about it, I'm thinking about, you know, the fact that there's college programs and all these things out there teaching entrepreneurship through acquisition. There's all the models you talked about where it's not somebody in a company as an employee who then wants to buy that. And I think of like the supply and demand issue in economics. And I think the common stat that everyone will reference probably forever, especially business brokers, but that 80% of businesses don't sell. And how much of that is a supply and demand problem where there's just not enough buyers who know about it. Obviously, there's a whole bunch of sellers who don't have a good business. It's not ready. They want too much money. But like, you know, where that will even out, like you said, is where there's going to be more of a thing that people want to buy businesses as their future instead of just something that happens. Like, what do you think about that? Do you see that solving some of the imbalance of businesses that don't sell?
Yeah, I would say most of the time when I see that, it's more the brokers, the reason that it's not selling, whether they're not pricing it accurately, they're kind of taking the seller's idea of what it should be worth and hoping and praying that someone will come buy it, rather than having some tough conversations and telling them either you're not ready to sell or this isn't where it's going to sell for. But if you think about it long term, the buyers that we've been having the last 3 to 5 years, their goal is usually to come in, run the business efficiently. They're usually coming from a professional environment with some regulation. They're a lot less likely to sort of run the business the way that a seller is, that's making it difficult to sell. And so in another 5 to 15 years, hopefully it's this cycle where those good buyers become good sellers. And now we have better businesses to sell to the good buyers that are coming in. And as more of the business schools get on board with ETA, we should be, you know, kind of creating these good buyers that can pick up these good businesses. And most of those people will either sell and retire, sell and maybe move up to something larger, move into a whole different realm of like independent sponsor or something else. Or they may, you know, continue to buy more and more businesses and kind of put them together. So, you know, that's kind of my long-term vision of it. And more or less, it's like what I really hope will happen. But then I also think we are starting to see some changes in the business broker world that are showing some kind of signs of improvement there. And I'm hoping that continues as well with that.
If I was more of a forecasted minded person and I either liked doing that or was good at it, it would be an interesting thought conversation, like for us to have, you and I, about what that cycle would look like in that 5 to 15 years, where the professional buyers and the skilled operators are buying businesses now and then looking to sell them down the road. And then what that wave of really higher quality businesses are available. I had Claudio Vilas on the show, and he focuses on roofing, and his big thing is like high quality versus low quality as far as a business that's ready to sell, right? And having a high quality product versus, you know, business that's not really ready to sell. And so if the market was full of higher quality products out there, then what does that do to the then buyer pool there? What do people want to buy? Who can actually afford it? And will that push people back into getting jobs because they can't afford the now asking price of these high quality businesses for sale?
Yeah, and we sort of see that already, right? Because we've got a lot of buyers. A lot of the searches, you ask them, what are you looking for? It's always kind of the same. 750 to a million, 250 in EBITDA. It's like, you know, no concentrations in an industry I can roll up. It's like sort of the same type of search. So when you have a large concentration of buyers kind of all fishing in the same small pond with a little bit of fish, it gets competitive. It's either pushing up prices or they've got to set themselves apart from another buyer to where the seller is sort of in control of who they sell it to. Most of the sellers want to sell to somebody who's going to actually come in and continue to run the business and improve it, not come in and lay off half the staff you know, run the business into the ground. And so if that continues, right, if the sellers continue to get better, we have better businesses with better financials, better margins, all that kind of stuff, it's going to get more competitive, and it may even push the price ranges up too high to where either, you know, they're going to have to come in with a lot of money in order to put any kind of leverage on it, or it may just push it up to a realm that SBA can't reach with, especially right now with a $5 million loan limit. So it may create like a whole nother kind of middle market acquisitions that are a little easier to get done than they are today.
Yeah. And I just wonder where, when that happens, then I think of things like the early 2000s residential loan, you know, the loan products that were out there, which then eventually caused some issues, and were part of the meltdown that happened, and where that could happen on the lending side. If there's, you know, there's, it's too hot of a market, and then somebody starts lending in some way, and what could be, but
I think yeah, we had that already sort of like,
really? With,
yeah, I would say like mid 2020 to about maybe towards the end of 2022, we had a lot of lenders that aren't normally going after acquisition financing kind of come in and make loans that they probably shouldn't have. You kind of pair that with rising interest rates, and it was sort of a disaster for a lot of people. The SBA was doing 90% guarantee and then also had 6 months of no payments because of COVID. So you had a lot of banks that said, normally they don't want anything to do with acquisition financing, and said, hey, let's go and jump into this because it's hot and we can also sell these loans on the secondary market for a high amount.
Yeah.
And then those rates almost doubled. They made some loans they probably shouldn't have already, or these people were highly leveraged, and it was a recipe for disaster. So fortunately, it wasn't a bloodbath like the real estate market in 2009, but it did sort of create a little bit of a correction where some of those lenders are gone now, or they decided to go back into what they normally would do. But it also wiped out some of the buyers that maybe were flirting with the idea, and then decided, this is pretty tough. I think I'm okay keeping my, you know, good salaried W-2 wage job and, you know, taking care of my family. So
yeah. And again, that's, I'm just thinking, like, when does that happen where the market just prices out the people who currently can get into it, that executive who got laid off or wants to, you know, go from what they're doing and move into something else. And, you know, where does the market not affordable for them, anything but private equity. And then you have some kind of like division. I don't know. That'd be a fascinating, like, different topic. Again, I'm not great at forecasting. I am generally a late bloomer and behind. So I am definitely not good at looking too far ahead. Now, one thing that you mentioned a couple times about brokers, obviously the Business Broker Growth Show, so we should probably talk about brokers at some point. You are on an interesting side because you, on the SBA lending side, like I said in the intro, you are focused on lending to buyers. And so brokers are something you kind of have to deal with, but you basically are not there for the brokers, right? So it's not like something on the seller side. This is more on the buyer side. So you have an interesting perspective of brokers. You made a couple comments about brokers so far. One of the ones that kind of shocked me is you said that the quality of brokers you've seen increase. Let's talk about that. Like, with your interactions with brokers, because you're working for the buyers, like, where does that fit in? What's the good, bad, and ugly? Like, what comes to mind when you think of business brokers?
Big topic, right? And I think it's funny too, because, like, going back to talking about like the searchers, right? I mean, I think it's no secret that the searchers and the brokers don't necessarily like each other, but I feel like both of them have valid reasons for it.
Interesting.
And I'm trying to get them to play nice because I get stuck in the middle, as you mentioned. So the brokers don't love the searchers or sort of have a bad taste in their mouth, because when things got really crazy, a couple of years ago, you had a lot of searchers come into the space and say, you know, I want to be a searcher. Maybe they saw on social media, you know, somebody saying, oh, hey, you can buy two businesses and it's easy or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so they went out and made all these offers on all these listings, but couldn't come through with the financing because they didn't have that lined up and they weren't really ready to buy. So naturally the brokers are like, I don't want to deal with them. But then on the searcher side or buyer side, what they deal with a lot are overpriced businesses, businesses that are not, you know, listed properly, you know, kind of, I wouldn't call it fraud, but, you know, they're maybe getting some practices that are a little unethical sometimes. And so they've sort of created this like butting of heads. And so what I've been trying really hard to do is get the brokers to understand they're not going away. This is your buyer. This is going to be your buyer from now on. So you need to lean in. And then same with the searchers. You need to understand that the brokers aren't going to go away, and there's absolutely a place for a broker on a transaction. So you need to kind of learn how to deal with them and you know, who are the good ones and what to look out for, and kind of educate yourself and make sure you've got the right people on your kind of team that'll help you kind of navigate that. I mean, that's kind of where I see that going. And then as far as, you know, good and bad, and in between, right, on the brokers, I'd say about maybe 6 or 7 years ago, I kind of made a little bit of a pivot where before my primary kind of marketing target were business brokers. I would go to them. I was trying to get them to send me leads. They often are the best lead, you know, generation, because they're getting buyers coming to them, and then they tell the buyer, hey, you know, you don't have your financing lined up, use this individual. But what I sort of noticed was that they weren't extremely loyal. So they were always looking for who will pay the highest referral fee rather than working with the best individual. And I feel like that a lot of them that played that game sort of circled back to people and realizing, oh, I'm trying to get more money by referring this, but I really should work with the person that's going to get this done. And I've seen people sort of say, you know, stop sending me stuff. And then a year later, hey, Jared, so sorry, I'm back. Okay, cool. No problem. You know, let's go. And so I kind of made a little bit of an effort to say, I'm going to work more directly with buyers. I'm going to work with them anyways. But if I can work with the buyer on the front end, I can help mold their search and help them put LOIs together, teach them how to look at transactions and create better buyers, then the brokers kind of have no choice but to work with them anyways. And so what I sort of did was kind of filter through the brokers and decide which ones were ones that I like working with, that I want to continue to work with. And if there's one that, you know, I don't dislike them, but I'm also not going to spend a lot of time marketing to them. If they work with me, great. If they don't, you know, it's fine. It's also a little bit less competitive, right? I mean, most SBA lenders are going after the business brokers because of obvious reasons, but not a lot of them understand how to get to the buyers directly. And so I kind of said, oh, I'm going to go over here, become really good at that side and try to talk to them. But of course, not ignore the brokers and work with them as much as I can.
Yeah, it makes sense. I could really see that. I had a short foyer as a residential loan officer early 2000s. And it was interesting to see the realtors who, you know, would try to send their clients to a lender, you know, couldn't pay referral fees, but there were ways you could pay for marketing and stuff like that. And they would try to do this and inevitably, you know, given enough time, they would learn who actually could close deals as a lender and who couldn't. And then you'd have people come back, or you'd see them like stick with who they, and truly, like, I know this person, I know how they work as a lender. I'm just going to keep doing business with them because I can ensure my deals are done. I think the challenge is, you know, got to be careful to not just, you know, on the business broker side, say, hey, this is my lender, use them, because it's, you know, it's got to be an open kind of referral recommendation, and not just like a single person, right? I know there's some issues with that, but I think it makes sense. And it's, you know, I've also heard what I see as really good business brokers out there who, before they list a business, they go to an SBA lender and get it basically pre-approved to make sure that it is, you know, fundable as a business, and then prove that it is, and then obviously make sure everything lines up so that when a buyer comes in, whoever they use, then now, do you ever have anybody approach you on that? Is that something you have done or would do?
Yeah, we definitely do that. I do that a lot. I would say I probably still look at 5 to 10 a week, where they're saying, hey, I'm getting ready to list this. Can you give me your opinion? I always tell them, if you do that, I will be 100% honest with you. And there are times, interesting enough, where I look at it and I go, this, you could sell this for a lot more. Like, you need to increase the price. You know, I've done 5 of these recently and this is what they sold for, you know, or they're kind of missing one or two things that they don't understand is actually making it a really good listing. And then of course, there's also a lot of times where I've got a buyer looking for that and I can connect the two and say, here you go. Now you don't have to list it. There's somebody that wants it. There you go. And a lot of them that have figured that out, then they're like, oh, I'm going to send you everything because, you know, it works. But yeah, we definitely do that. I will try to look through the transaction, give as much feedback as I can. Sort of newer ones, will often learn that maybe from somebody that's older in their shop that'll say, oh, Jared's the guy, send it to him. He'll tell you, you know, if you're crazy or if you're where you should be on the price. So, I enjoy doing that. I love looking at deals and kind of seeing what's going on in the market. So it's kind of fun.
Knowing you in the entrepreneurial side, like you were talking about this, you know, from growing up, having two businesses, selling one of them, I feel like if I were in that role, it'd be really tough for me. It's like, there was a period of time where I was really into fish tanks, like tropical fish tanks. And I worked at an aquarium pet store and I ended up with like 5 fish tanks in my bedroom. Like, I was still living at home. And it's like every day I would just come home with new fish and new stuff. And like, I feel like if I were you in that position, I'd be like, all right, hey honey, we're buying a new business. This is what I'm buying today.
Yeah. I could definitely see where that could happen. There's been many times where I'm talking to a buyer, I'm like, how did you find this? This is a great deal. If you decide you don't want it, let me know. Right. I may finally like give this up and go take that on. But yeah.
Well, for now, don't. I'm glad that you haven't bought a whole bunch of businesses along the way and done that. And I think it is interesting, you know, talking about the dynamic between the buyers and the brokers and somewhat adversarial. I mean, I think the challenge is, and this is what's fascinating about this whole industry as I've become a part of it, is that there's the brokers, which are generally very low licensed entities, right? Maybe a real estate license as a requirement. And then the good ones get other license and certifications and add on to their credentials in a professional way, which is great. But the barrier to entry is basically nothing, right? Even the 17 states that require a real estate license, like, come on, it's a 60-hour course. Like, it's there's not much that prepares you for this. And so you have this somewhat fiduciary representing a seller, and then you have a buyer that probably is unrepresented. And so then they're going head to head, and then that dynamic. And then I think one other thing that's fascinating that you and I have talked about in the past too, is that generally, and this is a generalization for anyone listening or watching, is that generally business brokers are older. They've gone through an executive, season for 20, 30 years in a career, and now they're out there, or they had a business and then they, you know, or whatever, and then they sold the business and then decided, hey, I want to be a business broker. And there's all kinds of ways that happens. And so, but they're dealing with a probably younger group of the search funders, the ETAs, the buyers out there, the ones that are following the gurus and saying, hey, that sounds great. Like, I could buy a business. Why not? Because I read a book about it and I follow someone on Instagram that says I can do it. And so like, then where is that? Where do you see that rub of like old and or old school? And then like the new buyers?
Yeah, definitely. I think that's one of the big challenges. And to be fair, there are some older business brokers that are actually really good. What I've kind of noticed is it's usually the ones that don't need any money. I've made the joke many times that like, when somebody's rushing a transaction, it's like, it's not your problem that the business broker is about to have their house foreclosed on. Like, you need to close the transaction. And I've dealt with deals like that where the business broker's like, I have to close this. Like, I'm behind. I need this commission, this and that. I'm like, it's not a good place to be. But then when you have some of the older brokers that have sold, you know, multiple businesses or, you know, retired and they're sort of doing it for fun. They're, you know, they sort of have the leverage, right? Well, if you don't want to take my list, if you don't want me to take your listing, and you don't want to listen to me, well, whatever, I'll go back to fishing or whatever, you know? And I feel like that's kind of always been my advice to business brokers is take stuff you can actually sell and that like sellers that actually listen to you, make sure it's priced accurately. Your life will be a lot easier. Instead of the ones that are maybe acting more like older, like used car salesmen, trying to pull the wool over people's eyes or, you know, just really not honing their craft and understanding how to price a business or, you know, how to work through it. And then, as you mentioned, some of them could be older. They're not understanding some of the kind of newer ways people are doing due diligence or the ways that transactions go about or even how pricing works. And so when you have sort of this new buyer coming in, and a lot of them have come from larger M&A, and they're sort of applying those principles that they learned to the smaller set, and it's causing some friction because the seller's like, you know, well, why are you asking me for all this stuff? Like, it's not how I've done it for 25 years. And it's like, yeah, well, sorry, this is how we're doing it. We're trying to get better at this. Like, you know, so
Yeah. And it is interesting, right? And again, using the terms like older business brokers, right? Like there's an age aspect to it where, you know, it biases more towards older in like later in life. It's also, you know, again, to what your point, what you said, there's some that maybe had a career, had a business, they sold that business, they got into business brokerage, and they're all about systems, technology, they're doing marketing, they're using an actual CRM, they're treating their business brokerage like a business, and they're running it like that. And then there's other ones that are doing it like a hobby or doing it like a solopreneur thing that they're just kind of hobbling things together. And then, you know, you said the used car sales. There's also, you know, what I know out there is some younger used car salespeople who got into business brokerage, low barrier to entry. I can make a bunch of money. This should be great. Don't realize how long it could take to actually get paid. And then the pressure comes in and then like, hey, I really need to get paid. And then that dynamic like is always there.
Yeah. And I think a lot of them, it's bad training, right? Bad research, bad experience for them. They may come in and they're working with a, you know, somebody that's using some of those bad tactics and they think that's normal and that's just how they do it. But yeah, they sort of think, well, I can sell real estate. That's easy. And then, but I can go, which it's not, right? But then they think so. And then they go in and they go, oh, well, I can actually make more commission on a business transaction, but they don't understand the complexity of it and how hard it is. And then also the fact that like, you're so much more exposed and they get sued all the time. Like there's so many other things you have to deal with. And then I think the biggest part, which you kind of hit on, is there's not much in the way of regulation. Whereas real estate, being a real estate agent or broker, it's heavily regulated. You can only say certain things, use certain forms, do certain things. And if you do something wrong, you can actually get disciplined, lose your license, right? All those things. And then when it comes to business broker, it's like the wild west of just figure it out. And, you know, some people have figured it out and a lot of people haven't. So,
yeah. And where it's not regulated, I mean, because even so, like if you're doing a business transaction that has no real estate in a state that requires a real estate license, then there's still no forms for you to use, right? There's still no process. I know as a realtor, when I had that distinction for a little while, like you had to have your E&O insurance. You had to cover yourself just in case you errors or omissions and forgot something. Mm-hmm. And it's just fascinating. One of the other things, and then we'll move on to the next segment because I'm excited to hear what you think from like a broker marketing standpoint, but this is a good segue, is that for you, you told me once that you have newer brokers come to you. They see you, maybe they see you content, the guy with the hat, which we could talk about as well. But they come across you somehow and they say, okay, so if you were me, what would you do as a new broker out there, even though you're not a broker? you know, and so what do you generally tell them, or what's the advice for any maybe new brokers and or like struggling brokers here in this?
Yeah, no, it's a great topic. I think probably the best example at a broker named Jason Ward, he's in like Austin, Houston area, came to me and he said, "Hey, I saw a presentation you did about working capital and why working capital should be included in a business. And I actually just pulled up the slides from it yesterday because I'm going to do a working capital presentation. I'm like, I wonder what that thing looked like." And it was from 2022. And it was kind of funny seeing it. And then there was a whole section I did about rising interest rates, which I need to go back and check, like if I was actually right about the forecast on that. But so Jason came to me and he said, "Hey, I saw the presentation, you know, can I pick your brain?" I said, "Sure, of course. What, like, you know, what can I do?" He's like, "Well, I'm newer. I'm a CPA, but I want to get into business brokerage. What advice would you have for me?" I said, "Oh, I would love to answer this question." And so kind of just went through, and mainly the main things I told him was, you know, don't take listings you can't sell. Really pay attention to the seller right away. If they're not nice, if they, you know, they're not giving you what you're actually looking for, they're not complying with kind of what you're, you know, explaining to them is the process, move on. Like it does, there's some out there that I swear people tell them just take listings for, to get reps. And it's like, no, that's the one of the worst things you could do. You get stuck in this loop of, I could maybe sell this. You know, it's like throwing chips on a roulette table and hoping the ball lands in the number, right? No. You know, look at the probability and all of that. And it's like, doesn't work. So with him, I kind of walked through, okay, if you price a business and you list a business based on how an SBA lender is going to underwrite it, you'll have a much higher likelihood of selling that because a good majority of your buyers are going to need SBA financing. So you're sort of working backwards saying, I'm already taking care of that side of it so that I know if I get a sophisticated buyer, they're gonna analyze the transaction the same way that a lender is gonna do it. So I might as well set it up for success from the beginning. But then what I think a lot of people don't understand is you're not wasting your time, you're not wasting your marketing dollars. And you're the biggest thing that they're not paying attention to is you're not creating a bad reputation in the market. You're creating a reputation of actually selling. Like you mentioned, 80% of them don't sell.
Yeah.
If you flip that and 80% of yours do sell, who's the person that's going to get all the listings? The person that has an 80% success rate, right?
Yeah.
And I said, then you sort of have the luxury of kind of going up market where maybe you say, you know, for now I'll take on any listings as long as it's priced accurately, I have a nice seller and I can get it moved, right? And then you could change it to, well, now I'm busy, I have demand because I actually have proven that I know how to sell these. I can go up. Minimum's going to be 1 million, then 2 million, then 3 million, you know, and you can kind of decide what you want to do to where you're concentrating your time and marketing to where you can make the most amount of money. And that's exactly what he did. And I still work with him all the time. I think I have 2 transactions with him right now. He's great. You know, super nice guy, understands the market, understands how to list things. I think only one time he's brought me a listing and I said, "Hey, you didn't follow my rules. Like this one sucks." You know, he's like, "I know, like, you know, we'll talk through it." But people like that end up having a really, really successful career and making a lot of money because they're getting really good listings and they're able to sell them. They're able to control their time and what they work on and what they market and who they want to work with. So that's kind of been my sort of number one thing is, of course, outside of that, really learn everything, set yourself up for success. One of the other big things that I've been telling people now is the buyers are doing proper due diligence. So do that on the front end. Do a quality of earnings with your seller. It's going to give you a true picture into the figures that you're, you know, putting out into the marketplace saying, this is what I'm representing and this is why I listed at this price. and you don't 100% know, right? I mean, you're taking someone's tax returns and financials and looking at them, and you're pricing a business. Of course, now you can have all these disclaimers that say, you know, this seller provided these to me and I'm not representing them and blah, blah, blah. But at the end of the day, if you have a third party evaluate those financials, you have a much higher likelihood of selling to a good buyer who's going to request that information anyways. You have a much better likelihood of getting the financing done, and you become a broker that searchers now like instead of dislike. And, you know, so you're basically kind of rigging the game, right? Because you're going, I've going to take away all your objections and I'm going to give you a shortcut to the end, to the finish line. I already did these four things that I know you're going to do. Now you can double check them or have your own people do it, but I've already done it and here you go. And that's where I'm starting to see some of these brokers understand and lean in on the new type of buyer they're getting and setting it up for success.
Yeah. And it's really like that second point there of especially the QOE, like Elliot Holland was on the show and we talked a lot about that and the value to the seller to be analyzing that and being aware. It goes into like the general premises. When you're selling something, you should fully understand how a buyer's going to look at it. And a lot of times sellers, this is salespeople in general, want to only focus on the good things and just sweep all the bad things under the rug and hope nobody asks or notice. And in this kind of a transaction, you just assume that something is going to pop up that you're hoping no one's going to see. And I think the professional brokers that I know, they're okay with that. They uncover those things, like you said, like the ones who bring it to you to look at it from an SBA side, the ones who would get a QOE analysis so that they're ready. There is no mystery. There's no surprise. They have an answer and an explanation for everything. And it is what it is. Like, I think that's such a huge thing going along with what you said of like taking the listings that you want with good people that you want to work with that are priced appropriately.
Yeah. And I mean, and let's not forget as well, like you're dealing with somebody's livelihood, somebody's family's future. Like that is extremely serious. You have somebody putting several hundred thousand dollars into a transaction, signing personal guarantees for a loan. How can you look yourself in the mirror and say, yeah, I made several hundred thousand dollars on this transaction, but I know deep down that I screwed this person over and it's not a good thing. And obviously it'll just continue to ruin the industry and ruin, you know, families. Now, of course, there are stuff sellers do that you have no control over and you may think you had the right people, but if you're trying to get someone to buy something just because you're trying to make commission on it and not doing what's right for them, that's really bad when it blows up and goes south.
Yeah, it's not going to go well. So I know that all of that, like you in the marketing tips and things that you did. Now I know you have one last one fifth one that's on the list because you shared it with me. What's the last tip for business brokers in this category?
Yeah, I say work with people that are nice and be nice to people.
Yeah,
it's not hard to do. It's probably actually easier. I try really hard to be nice to people. People say that all the time. Oh man, you're so nice. Like, you know, why? And I don't know. I just try to be. Now, don't mistake it for me being weak or anything, but at the end of the day, like, you know, there's a lot of people I work with that are really nice to me and I will bend over backwards for them to help them. But the second people are mean to me or treat me poorly, most of the time I just cancel their deal. Like, don't want to work on it. Go somewhere else. You're going to be mean to employees. You're going to ruin the business when you take it over. I don't want any part of that.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I've joked about this for years. There's 8 billion people on the planet, right? Like, good. I'm good. I'll be all right. Right. I want to deal with people who I want to deal with. And I love that. Right. And I think, you know, from learning so much from the brokers that we work with and really diving into their business and their decision factors is really they look at that seller and then how do they treat the broker? How do they treat others? And like, you know, who do they really want to work with? Because unless you're running like a high volume brokerage, you're probably you probably don't have an unlimited bandwidth for an unlimited number of listings. Now there's never an unlimited, but like, you know, there's some brokerages just doing hundreds a year as a team, but most brokers are doing a handful a year. Right. And so then everyone matters. And it's quality over quantity, not just of the price or the industry, but also the person you're now essentially marrying for the next 6 to 12 months as your client to work with.
And the same thing, the sellers, most of them, especially now, I'm hearing so much more with all the competition that they're being sort of picky with the buyers. I'm seeing buyers get listings at a different price than somebody else offered, and maybe even saving money because the seller is looking at it going, that's the person that I want to take over my business. They're not going to walk in and fire the lady that sits at the front desk that really runs the company. You know, and they're going to take care of these second, third generation employees that I have. They're not coming in and wiping everybody out. And that's who I feel comfortable with. So I'm willing to sell the business to them. And that's been nice to see. And I hope that continues.
And going back to the forecasting and prognosticating that I will not do, but I wonder in that, you know, 10, 15 year cycle where the buyers have basically the industry is replaced by the silver tsunami builders and the people who founded it in their garage mode to the buyers who bought it and then are selling it in 10 to 15 years, where there's, if that will change the concern about who's buying it, because now they don't have the day one founding growth with the people they treat like family. They bought a business. They get to like those people, but they see it more transactional. Like, I don't really care what the new buyer does with it, right? Like, I've done my cycle versus, you know, the sellers now, to your point, that really care about who's buying and what they're going to do with their legacy, right? It's different when you buy a legacy versus you build a legacy. I just wonder.
Well, I mean, I guess if the sellers do a good job of picking the right people, they would hope they'd kind of share the same ideas. So hopefully we'll find out. And you know, people could go in that way, right? Oh, I'm gonna build this for 5 years and then I'm gonna flip it and move on to the next thing. And that's probably their idea. Then they get in there and go, I could not do this without all these hardworking people. I don't want to do this to them. You know, hopefully their conscience gets a little softer.
Hopefully that's the way. And I think that's probably what's gonna human nature side. It's gonna be like, yeah, definitely. Like the next buyer needs to buy this as a team, because the only reason it's successful is because of the team. So, and before we move on to the last segment here, I love the fact that you brought up Jason Ward, and then I was already going to mention something and then you close the loop on it, like the, but where is he now moment, because I know that he started in 2020. It sounded like he talked to you around 2022. And I know, because I've spoken with him, is that he's active and he's doing well. And so I love that part, because I was worried for the audience to be like, yeah, I met this guy, Jason Ward, in 2022. And here's what I told him to do. It's like, oh, where is he?
Yeah. I talked to him yesterday, actually. It was funny. I'll tell you a real quick story. So I had a listing with him. It was a barbecue like restaurant, but there was also a meat market in Houston. We had a buyer. We were working on the transaction. Buyer lied to me, said that he canceled the transaction, wasn't moving forward anymore. Jason calls me and says, hey, you know, did you hear from the buyer? Yeah. Said he canceled the transaction. He goes, no, he was going with a different lender. I said, oh, he lied to me. He goes, yeah. So seller doesn't really like him that much. Said that if there's another buyer, whoever gets the commitment letter from the lender first will get the deal. I said, okay, great. I've got some buyers. So I took that as a fun challenge. I knew the lender they went with, and I knew they were slow and didn't really know what they were doing. So had another transaction that had just fallen through with a phenomenal buyer, super nice guy, again, right? Nice people. Went to him and said, hey, would you want to buy this? I know you want to move to Houston. I think he was living in maybe Abilene or something like that. And he wanted to get down to Houston to be by his adult kids and his grandkids. He said, I've got a listing for you. Broker's great. It's a good deal. If you want it, you have to move quickly. And he said, okay, looked at it, said, yeah, let's do it. Long story short, I got it approved before the other bank, got him the deal. He got it done. The buyer and the lender called and yelled at Jason forever. And Jason kind of said, yeah, you cemented why I work with Jared and not other people. And so Jason calls me the other day, goes, hey, remember the, you know, barbecue deal? Of course I do. You know, it's like one of my favorite deals ever. And And he goes, well, do you remember the other meat market you did in Conroe? Said, yeah, of course. You know, okay, well, they want to sell it to the other guy that you did, you know, the deal for.
Nice. I said,
awesome. Let's go. So now we're working on a transaction like that. You know, it's been fun to kind of see, well, I did both of these and then, you know, got to work with Jason. So I get to work with them again. And then we'll watch them expand and kind of grow the business. And so it's, that's awesome. That type of stuff's really fun when you end up getting to work with the same people again. So,
yeah, definitely. Definitely some interesting lessons in there and wrapping back to, you know, dealing with nice people and good people. And definitely for anyone listening to this, we started out the conversation, Jared mentioned it. He is competitive. I know for myself, I am a Scorpio only child, so I'm not always competitive unless you upset me and then it's on, right? Like I'm good. I'm cool. You can win all you want unless, you know, I feel wronged and then it's over. So, I love that. Now, let's the last segment we usually do is the deal that got away. Obviously, it's interesting for you because this would be lessons of the lost deal. Typically for brokers, obviously you have a lot of financing ones. We could have put that one in the category, but it didn't get away. You actually still made it happen with the barbecue meat market buyer, just a different buyer. You know, what comes to mind as a good maybe cautionary tale for the brokers out there listening to this from your specific SBA side or the buyers out there who found this episode, they're listening, they want to learn from you of what they should be looking for, how they operate successfully. Like what comes to mind of one of these deals?
Yeah, there's been so many different ones that, you know, either didn't work because our credit team didn't agree with, you know, the underwriting or transaction. I would say the majority of those, they ended up being right. You know, which is why, again, we have, you know, good credit people within the bank to make sure we're not doing every deal just because we like it. One that really comes to mind is, and this was, gosh, it must have been 10 years ago, maybe even longer. I don't remember specifically what, oh no, sorry. They were buying a in-home, like healthcare, you know, they were basically hire a nurse, comes in, takes care of elderly people or somebody that's sick. They had another business. I do not remember exactly what the business was, but we were working on the transaction, moving along, had it approved, and we were waiting for their financials, their tax returns to be done for their existing business. The lady sends over the tax returns to me. I kind of work through them. She sent him over to the underwriter as well because we were working together, and we go, wow, their, you know, profitability dropped drastically. This is not good. Their existing business is hemorrhaging cash. You know, I don't think we should do another one. So we reach out to her. We say, hey, sorry, we're not going to be able to move forward at this point because your existing business isn't doing very well. She goes, wait, which tax returns did I send you? I didn't send you the right ones. I just sent the ones where I didn't want to pay much in taxes. You know, here's our real P&L. You can see that we just chopped off a couple $100,000 in revenue, so we don't have to pay taxes. I'm like, seriously? Like, you think that's okay? Yeah, no. So we ended up, you know, not doing the deal, of course. So they sort of kind of killed their own deal by not being honest and ethical. So even though that one got away, it was kind of more like it needed to go away. They did it to themselves. You know, had they have been honest and gave us the real tax returns from the very beginning, we would have closed the deal. Everything would have been fine. We would have moved forward. But, you know, you're willing to cheat the IRS by that much. What else are you willing to do? You know, so.
Yeah. And it's true, right? And you think, okay, well, I'm just playing the game on the tax returns. It's like, okay, playing the game on the tax returns is one thing, but it's another one to do what you're talking about there. And it does make it difficult. And I know on the lending side, like once that happens, it's over, right? Mm-hmm. It's
not much. And buyers are definitely paying attention to that more and more. You know, if they get a deal they're working on and the seller says, well, there's also a bunch of cash that I'm not reporting or I'm doing this and that. A lot of buyers that say, I'm done, not moving forward. If that's what you're willing to do, there's probably some other stuff you're doing that's not good that I'm not going to be able to discover until I actually get in there and run the business. And again, you're putting your family's future and money on the line. It's not worth it.
Yeah. And that is a really good point, right? Because how people handle some things is usually how they handle all things or most things, and mm-hmm. who they are is basically who they are. And so to that point, yeah, I could see if I was a buyer, I would totally be looking for those red flags of like, okay, if you're willing to do that, where else are you cutting corners in the business? What am I really going to be buying? Yeah. and taking over with no recourse, right? Like, yeah. I don't have a choice with what I bought.
Yeah. An investor friend that I work with named Adam, he always says, however a seller tells you they are, believe them. And so.
Yeah. I love that. That's true. All right. Well, Jared, this has been great. I appreciate everything that you shared here. I think it's been fun. I've learned a lot. I always do in these conversations because I think it's so fascinating and I love business. And I would definitely have been in trouble if I was in your spot and there was a barbecue meat market that came up for sale. I would definitely own a chain of those or a bunch of those locations. You just ask my wife. Like I would be bringing home every barbecue place that came up, especially if I was in your state as well. I would, yeah. Oh man, be eating so well. But I appreciate everything. Now for anyone in the audience that wants to get in touch with you, your links, everything will be in the show notes. Best ways is jaredwjohnson.com because there's other Jared Johnsons out there. So make sure if you Google, find the right Jared W. Johnson. So jaredwjohnson.com. Also on LinkedIn at Jared W. Johnson. And then your email will be in there. Also have your podcast, Before You Buy or Sell a Business. Pretty descriptive title. It's a good job on that one.
Long,
that leaves nothing to the imagination on what that podcast is about.
Yeah, exactly. I appreciate you having me on, man. I enjoyed it. We'll have to get you on my podcast. It'll be fun. Or we can do this again anytime.
Yeah, it's been great. And I appreciate this. We're going to do the after show because I have a few more questions I want to ask you for everyone else tuning in. I appreciate you being here. It's really been kind of a mission and a focus that's shifted over time of the podcast and even the businesses to highlight, you know, the professionals out there. And Jared, to me, really speaks to that professional, not just the 10,000 hours that he's put in, not just all the effort, not the overnight success that he has and where he's positioned himself, but like all the stuff that he does and cares about and the things out there. So hopefully you find some value from this and help you on your professional journey as a broker, could be a fellow SBA lender competitor, although you're way behind and Jared's definitely going to keep kicking your butt, but that's, you know, that's a different thing. Or for the buyers out there, business owners, hopefully you got some value from this. I appreciate everyone tuning in, and until next time, stop hoping for deals and start growing your pipeline.
Thanks for tuning in to the Business Broker Growth Show hosted by Jason Cutter. If today's episode helped you think differently about how to build your pipeline and grow your business, share it with another broker who's ready to make the shift from hoping for listings to engineering them. Join us again for the next episode of the Business Broker Growth Show, where brokers become trusted advisors.